this episode, Royal London. Presented by Andy Hallett and Adam Scott Goulding.
Hello again. We're doing the Royal London podcast this month. I'm just approaching St. Paul's Cathedral. I've just finished the Ghost of the Old City Walk. It's Adam here, and I'm here to meet Andy, and there he is.
Hello, Andy.
Hi. How are you?
Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you. How was your Hidden Pubs
good.
Walk?
Very, very good indeed. Yeah, we visited three pubs, as always. We entered the Punch Tavern, which is great. Yeah, it was great. Yeah, I think they all enjoyed it. I hope they did.
I'm sure they did. Fantastic. Now, we're here at St. Paul's Cathedral to ask you about King George the Sixth.
King George the Sixth, yes, because I did a play about, it was about 10 years ago or so, and it was a one-man show. It was written by a guy called Andrew Neil. He directed it, and he wrote the play as well. But yeah, George the Sixth, he was born 1895, December the 14th, 1895. It was unfortunate, actually, because he was born on the anniversary of Prince Albert, Queen Victoria's Prince Albert's death. Okay. So that kind of distressed Queen Victoria to some extent. So he was named Albert to kind of mollify her, essentially, I think, a little bit. So he was known as Albert Frederick Arthur George.
Right.
But the family name for him was Bertie, which is confusing because I think Edward VII, the family name was Bertie. His brother, his elder brother David, was named Edward Albert Christian Andrew Patrick David.
Hello, it's Adam here again. When Andy and I sat down to listen to the playback of that introduction to the Royal London podcast, Andy noticed what perhaps some of the more eagle-eared listeners out there have just spotted, that he had misspoken slightly in the litany of names given to the former king, a veritable festival of names there, sounding like he was reading out from the St. James's phone directory, that he misspoke there. I don't think there's a court in the land that would hold him responsible for making a slight slip of the tongue in such a long list of names. So here he is to correct his mistake.
Edward Albert Christian George Andrew Patrick David.
Andy, thank you very much. Now, on with the podcast.
A festival of names, absolutely. And what we're doing here, so this is where George stood. I didn't know this, Adam.
St. Paul's Cathedral, just chiming 9:30 there. St. Paul's Cathedral, King George VI opened the Festival of Britain from here in 1951.
Right.
And it's a royal church as well, I suppose, in so much as the wedding of Charles and Diana here in 1981.
Yeah.
One of the more vivid episodes in the great soap opera.
Yeah, yeah. Are we fans of the royals?
Well, I keep an open mind on all things. I said that on the Ghosts podcast as well, didn't I?
Occupational hazard.
Well, we have a range of takes on our royal family in our podcast here. A little bit later on, I'm going to talk about men's clothing and fashion in light of the royal family, the Windsors, Edward VII particularly.
Right.
We've got Karen a little bit later on discussing the Duke of Clarence.
Wonderful, brilliant.
In relation to the Jack the Ripper case. And our colleague Sean has a couple of anecdotes to brighten up the proceedings.
This is an anecdote from some time ago. This was Prince Charles as he was talking to members of the cabinet at a Buckingham Palace supper. And he was saying to them, "Well, you know, this job that I do, it's terribly boring. It's very boring." And they all laughed. And he said, No, it is. It's incredibly boring." Well, Dennis Healy was then Chancellor, I think, said to him, "Well, you don't have to do it, sir." Charles said, "Oh, yes." I think he thought a bit about that afterwards and carried on with the job.
Thank you, Sean. More from Sean later. But first, here's Andy in the role of King George the Sixth in Andrew Neil's play King George the Sixth in Heaven, Given That There Is a God, which moved one reviewer to use the phrase subversive stuff.
At about the time of Lilibet's 13th birthday, we began to consider who she might eventually marry. One possibility was Prince Gorm of Denmark, but we excluded him. I can't remember why. Then there was Philip. Now, Philip's mother, Alice, deaf Alice, had been locked away in an institution in Switzerland when Philip was 10, and Philip sent to England to be brought up by his maternal grandmother, the Dowager Marchioness of Milford Haven. The two boys in that household were Louis Mountbatten and his older brother George, the actual Marquess. George engaged in penetrative sex with both men and women, and was possessed with a love of pornography. Perhaps he influenced Philip unduly. We want to know, at the time, and this was late 38, early 39, remember, his credentials were impeccable. He was born in Greece to a German-Danish father of the house of Schleswig-Holstein-Sonderburg-Glücksburg, and a German mother, Alice Battenberg. He was sixth in line to the Greek throne. His four older sisters had all married high-ranking German noblemen, one of whom was an SS colonel on Herr Himmler's personal staff. His sister Sophie had even named her eldest son Karl Adolf in honour of the German Chancellor. He was Lilibet's second cousin, once removed through King Christian IX of Denmark, her third cousin through Queen Victoria, and her fourth cousin, once removed through King George III. Through the marriage of King George I of Hélène to the Grand Duchess Olga, granddaughter of Tsar Nicholas I, his family included 16 kings of the House of Oldenburg, 7 Tsars of Russia, 6 kings of Sweden, and 3 kings from the House of Schleswig, Holstein, Sonderburg, Glücksburg, Beck. Definitely worthy of serious consideration. I very much wanted to write to Herr Hitler in 1939 as one serviceman to another to stop the war. Neville Chamberlain, who, incidentally, I much preferred to Winston Churchill, dissuaded me, however. It was a mistake on his part, I feel. Even as late as 1941, my brother David was saying, it would be a tragic thing for the world if Herr Hitler was overthrown. Margaret was 9 years old when war broke out. Apparently Anne Frank, a little Jewish girl, had pictures of Margaret pinned to her attic wall. There were a few deprivations, as you'd expect, but not in terms of our rations, I'm pleased to say. No. We continue to have our eggs, bacon, roast beef, champagne, grice in season, the butter pets monogrammed with the royal coat of arms. The war brought us even closer. Us four, Elizabeth, me, Lilibet and Margaret, danced congas, played Bing Crosby records and vaudeville games. We did a lot of shooting on the estate. The year after the war ended, Philip gave up his Greek title, disavowed the Greek Orthodox Church, and joined the Church of England. He married Lilibet in November 47. Because of his numerous foreign relatives, particularly on the German side, I only allocated him 2 of the 2,500 invitations. But on the morning before the wedding, I knighted him with the Order of the Garter, making him Duke of Edinburgh, Earl of Merioneth and Baron Greenwich. It's a very great deal to give a man all at once.
It was a huge shocker thing that he was became king, but I don't think he was completely unprepared for it. His father had said, I pray to God that my eldest son will never marry and have children, and nothing will come between Bertie and the throne. And actually, amazingly, his father predicted that David wouldn't last a year, less than 12 months. Which is, he only lasted 325 days. It was amazingly pathetic things were said. But incredible life, of course.
Of all the royal scandals, most lurid of all remains the conspiracy theorist's favourite, the connection with the Jack the Ripper case. Here, Karen Pierce-Goulding reads from her book, Royal London, published last year by Crimson Publishing, examining the murky twilight between fact and fiction.
It is almost as if that most unfathomable of all London tales could not survive in the East End if it didn't have a royal element. That character so beloved of the movies, the gentleman killer in white tie and tails and silk hat, is all the more vivid if we have his carriage rattling along the Mall as both the sun and Buckingham Palace recede behind him. But before we set too dramatic a scene, gas lamps popping into limp life, wan faces lurching at the carriage window for arms, only to be beaten away by the driver's crop and all that business, let's pause to reveal the truth of the tale. The Duke of Clarence was not Jack the Ripper. Prince Albert Victor, Duke of Clarence and Avondale, Eddie to his family, was the oldest son of the Prince of Wales. He is first mentioned in connection with London's most lurid and addictive tale in 1962, some 74 years after the murders were committed. The case seems to have developed a life of its own, with each generation throwing up a new suspect. Broadly, the conspiracy theory runs thus. The Duke of Clarence was a hell of a fella for the prostitutes. Some versions have him fathering a child by a prostitute in the East End. Others say he married a fallen woman. Queen Victoria, as one might expect, was not amused. The shadowy forces of the authorities kidnap the subject of the Duke's affections and have her lobotomised, thus rendering her mute. The witnesses at the wedding are then hunted down one by one and killed to preserve the good name of the House of Saxe-Coburg and Gotha. Donald Rumbelow, the great ripperologist, whose prose is refreshingly free of the clammy enthusiasm that so often sticks to the pages of Ripper books, in his definitive The Complete Jack the Ripper, characterises the Duke as a reluctant soldier, a dandy with a weak constitution, not necessarily the captain of the pub quiz team. This last point alone, that he was not the sharpest tool in the box, gives rise to the counter theory that he would therefore lack the cunning to wield the sharpest tools in the box. History has him dead just 4 years later in the flu pandemic of 1892. Our theory from 1962 has him dead of syphilis, a convenient hook upon which to hang a Ripper conspiracy. Most sources accept that he was shooting in Scotland for at least two of the murders. But our conspiracy theorists rush in here again, saying that he may have been in a psychiatric institution near Sandringham, having been caught in a raid on a gay brothel in Cleveland Street. With Queen Victoria expressing concerns regarding the Duke's dissipation in private letters available to fan the flames, the story shows no signs of going away anytime soon.
One particular anecdote I remember from, it was when the Queen was shopping for the grandchildren in a shop, I think it was in Balmoral, wearing the headscarf and gum boots and a quilted barber jacket. This woman kept on staring at her. And in the end, a woman came up and said, "Excuse me, do you know, you look rather like the Queen." She said, "Oh, how very reassuring."
I'm in Jermyn Street, trespassing on Karen and Katie's beat here on their village in Piccadilly walk. It's also part of my suited and booted history of men's fashion walk, and that's why we're here in a royal context today, looking for two particular characters who shaped the face of modern men's fashion. I'm standing by St. James's Church on Jermyn Street, outside Hawes & Curtis shirt shop, founded in 1913. And it's at this particular location that we can bring in one of the spectres at the feast of the royal family. Andy alluded to him earlier on in this podcast, the brief and fleeting King Edward VIII, something of a style guru in his day. He had his shirts made here at Hawes & Curtis, not only made but laundered. He also had them make a backless waistcoat or vest, as it's called in America, for ease of movement when he was dancing. And we all know where dancing leads, particularly in his case, big trouble. We're often asked about Edward and Mrs. Simpson on the Roots of Our London walks, particularly by our visitors from North America. who still perhaps revel in this episode in, as we said, the soap opera, in which the man who would be king abdicated for the love of a woman, not only a divorcee, but, heaven forfend, an American. There is a great misconception that the Windsor Knot is named for this particular Edward of Windsor, who later, of course, became the Duke of Windsor. I think this is where the misconception comes from. But the knot in the necktie was actually named for his royal predecessor, King Edward VII. Wandering westward along Jermyn Street now, in the London rain here, perhaps you can hear it pitter-patting on my umbrella. Wandering westward here, we are treated to something of a colourful spectacle. Hoving into view here, a statue of the most stylish man in history, Beau Brummel, the man who invented many of the modern practices associated with men's personal grooming and hygiene today. Brushing teeth on a daily basis, for example, changing one's clothes regularly. Myth has it, polishing his boots in champagne, eventually bankrupting himself in an attempt to keep up with the people we're dealing with at hand here, the royal family. I've arrived at the western end of Jermyn Street now, at the famous Turnbull and Asser hosiers, glovers and shirt makers, established in the 1880s. Their shirts famously bear the royal warrant on the label inside the collar, the royal warrant of His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales, our current Prince of Wales. But again, his predecessor, his royal predecessor, King Edward VII, is a man with whom we wish to deal here, being a great style and trend setter. Everything from the dinner jacket, an idea about being able to have more comfort after dinner. Quite a portly and large fellow he was. Having lunched or suppered very well, he wished a coat in which he could, you know, relax and be less constrained. Going where else but Henry Poole, the founding father of the role. He asked for such an item to be made, such an item in this country known as the dinner jacket in North America, the tuxedo to this very day. A little joke very recently in, I think, the second series of Downton Abbey, where the Lord of the Manor is debating with his batman Bates about whether or not to wear such a garment, a dinner jacket, when dining with the Dowager Countess. Such modernity, it is suggested, would perhaps bring her a heart attack. Such an innovation was brought about for the comfort of King Edward VII, who also had his ties tailored in a fashion wide enough to create a very big and chunky knot. It's from this practice that we, with our modern off-the-peg neckties, create the Windsor Knot to echo the larger, chunkier tie as favoured by King Edward VII, who not only gives us those two male fashion innovations, but gives us also the practice of a gentleman undoing the bottom button of his waistcoat. Again, physical comfort here, a portly fellow who would often dine rather well. And when others saw King Edward VII undoing the bottom button of his waistcoat, they did likewise and followed suit. It is said, if you see a fellow in a vest without the bottom button undone, then you are being confronted by a fellow who is certainly not a gentleman.
This one's quite a nice one. Prince Philip and Her Majesty were riding in the Royal Land Rover around Sandringham, I think, in winter. And a woman was walking in front of them on the path, on the bridal path, with a couple of dogs, and she had to move aside for them to pass. And Prince Philip managed to steer the Land Rover into a huge puddle, and this plume of brown water shot all over this woman, and she yelled out something. And the Queen ran down the window and said, "I quite agree, madam." And she came back to the cab, and Philip said, "What did she say?" And the Queen said, "She said bastards." Thank you.
The London Walks podcast was compiled, produced and presented by Andy Hallett and Adam Scott Goulding.
This episode also featured the talents of Karen Pierce-Goulding and Sean Seymour.
For details of the full programme of London Walks, London's best guided walking tours, go to www.walks.com. The London Walks podcast was an APB production.